44. Death is not, I discovered, a pleasant experience. Leaving the familiar rooms on the Piazza di Spagna and the rapidly cooling body there is similar to being thrust out in the night by fire or flood from the familiar warmth of one's home. The rush of shock and displacement is severe. Thrown headlong into the metasphere, I experience the same sense of shame and sudden awkward revelation which we have all had in our dreams when we realize that we have forgotten to get dressed and have come naked to some public place or social gathering. Naked is the correct word now, as I struggle to keep some shape to my tattered analog persona. I manage to concentrate sufficiently to form this almost random electron cloud of memories and associations into a reasonable simulacrum of the human I had been, or at least the human whose memories I had shared. Mr. John Keats, 5 feet high. The metasphere is no less a frightening place than before. Worse now that I have no mortal shelter to flee to. Vast shapes move beyond dark horizons. Sounds echo in the void which binds, like footsteps on tile in an abandoned castle. Under and behind everything, there is a constant and unnerving rumble, like carriage wheels on a highway made of slate. Poor Hunt. I am tempted to return to him. Pop in like Marley's ghost to assure him that I am better off than I look. But old Earth is a dangerous place for me right now. The Shrike's presence burns on the metasphere datum plane there like flame on black velvet. The core summons me with greater force, but that is even more dangerous. I remember Uman destroying the other Keats in front of Braun Lamia, squeezing the analog persona to him until it simply dissolved. The basic core memory of the man deliquescing like a salted slug. No thank you. I have chosen death to godhood, but I have chores to do before I sleep. The metasphere frightens me. The core frightens me more. The dark tunnels of the datasphere singularities I must travel terrify me to my analog bones. But there is nothing for it. I sweep into the first black cone, swirling around like a metaphorical leaf in an all-too-real whirlpool, emerging on the proper datum plane, but too dizzy and disoriented to do anything but sit there, visible to any core AI accessing these ROM-work ganglia or phage routines residing in the violet crevices of any of these data mountain ranges. But the chaos in the techno-core saves me here. The great core personalities are too busy laying siege to their own personal Troys to watch their back doors. I find the datasphere access codes I want and the synapse umbilicals I need, and it is the work of a microsecond to follow old paths down to Tau Ceti Center, Government House, the infirmary there, and the drug-induced dreams of Paul Duret. One thing my persona does exceptionally well is dream, and I discover quite by accident that my memories of my Scottish tour make a pleasant dreamscape in which to convince the priest to flee. As an Englishman and free thinker, I once had been opposed to anything which smacked of popery. But one thing must be said in tribute to the Jesuits. They are taught obedience even above logic, and for once this stands all of humankind in good stead. Duret does not ask why when I tell him to go. He awakes like a good boy, wraps a blanket around him, and goes. Maynard Gladstone thinks of me as Joseph Severn, but she accepts my message as if it is being delivered to her by God. I want to tell her no, I am not the one, I am only he who comes before, but the message is the thing, so I deliver that and go. Passing through the core on my way to Hyperion's metasphere, I catch the burning metal whiff of civil war and glimpse a great light which might well be Uman in the process of being extinguished. The old master, if indeed it is he, does not cite koans as he dies, but screams in agony as sincerely as any conscious entity ever has who is in the process of being fed to the ovens. I hurry on. The Farcaster connection to Hyperion is tenuous at best, a single military Farcaster portal, and a single damaged jump ship in a shrinking perimeter of war-torn hegemony ships. The Singularity containment sphere cannot be protected from ouster attacks for longer than a few minutes more. The hegemony torch ship carrying the core Death Wand device is preparing to translate in-system, even as I come through and find my bearings in the limited datasphere level which allows observation. I pause to watch what happens next.
"Christ," said Milio Arendez. "Mayna Gladstone's coming through on a priority one squirt."
Theo Lane joined the older man as they watched the override data miss the air above the hollow pit. The consul came down the iron spiral staircase from the bedroom where he had gone to brood.
"Another message from TC Squared?"
he snapped.
"Not to us specifically," said Theo,
reading the red codes as they formed and faded.
"It's an override fatline transmission to everyone everywhere."
Arendez lowered himself into the pit cushions.
"Something's very wrong. Has the CEO ever broadcast on total wideband before?"
"Never," said Theo Lane. "The energy needed just to code such a squirt would be incredible."
The consul stepped closer and pointed to the codes now disappearing.
"It's not a squirt. Look, it's a real-time transmission."
Theo shook his head.
"We're talking transmission values of several hundred million giga-electron volts here."
Arendez whistled.
"At even 100 million GeV, it had better be important."
"A general surrender," said Theo. "It's the only thing that would call for a universal real-time broadcast. Gladstone's sending it to the Ousters, Outback Worlds, and Overrun Planets, as well as the Web. It must be carried on all comm frequencies, HTV, and datasphere bands, too. It must be a surrender."
"Shut up," said the consul. He had been drinking.
The consul had started drinking immediately upon his return from the tribunal, and his temper, which had been foul even as Theo and Arendez were slapping him on the back and celebrating his survival, had not improved after the liftoff, clearance of the swarm, and the 2 hours he spent alone drinking while they accelerated toward Hyperion.
"Mayna Gladstone won't surrender," slurred the consul. The bottle of scotch was still in his hand. "Just watch."
On the torch ship, H.S. Stephen Hawking, the 23rd hegemony spacecraft to carry the revered classical scientist's name, General Arthur Morpurgo looked up from the C-cubed board and hushed his two bridge officers. Normally, this class of torch ship carried a crew of 75. Now, with the core Death Wand device loaded in the weapons bay and armed, Morpurgo and 4 volunteers were the total crew. Displays and discreet computer voices assured them that the Stephen Hawking was on course, on time, and accelerating steadily toward near quantum velocities, and the military Farcaster portal, stationed at Lagrange Point 3, between Madya and its oversized moon. The Madya portal opened directly to the fiercely defended Hyperion space Farcaster.
1:18 to translation point,"
said Bridge Officer Salomon Morpurgo, the General's son. Morpurgo nodded and keyed up the in-system wideband transmission. Bridge projections were busy enough with mission data, so the General allowed voice only on the CEO's broadcast. He smiled despite himself. What would Mayna say if she knew he was at the helm of the Stephen Hawking? Better she didn't know. There was nothing else he could do. He preferred not to see the results of his precise, hand-delivered orders of the past 2 hours. Morpurgo looked at his oldest son with pride so fierce it bordered on pain. There were only so many torchship-rated personnel he could approach about this mission, and his son had been the first to volunteer. If nothing else, the Morpurgo family's enthusiasm might have allayed some core suspicions.
"My fellow citizens," Gladstone was saying, "this is my final broadcast to you as your chief executive officer. As you know, the terrible war which has already devastated 3 of our worlds and is about to fall upon a 4th has been reported as an invasion by the ouster swarms. This is a lie. The combands flared with interference and went dead.
Go to Fatline, said General Morpurgo.
1:03 to translation point,
intoned his son. Gladstone's voice returned, filtered and slightly blurred by Fatline encrypting and decoding.
To realize that our ancestors, and we ourselves, had made a Faustian bargain with a power not concerned with the fate of humankind. The Core is behind the current invasion. The Core is responsible for our long, comfortable, dark age of the soul. The Core is responsible for the ongoing attempt to destroy humanity, to remove us from the universe and replace us with a god-machine of their own devising.
Bridge Officer Salomon Morpurgo never lifted his eyes from the circle of instruments.
38 seconds to translation point.
Morpurgo nodded. The other two crewmen of the sea-cubed bridge showed faces sheened with sweat. The general realized that his own face was wet.
Have proven that the Core resides, has always resided, in the dark spaces between Farcaster portals. They believe themselves to be our masters. As long as the web exists, as long as our beloved hegemony is joined by Farcaster, they will be our masters.
Morpurgo glanced at his own mission chronometer.
28 seconds.
The translation to Hyperion system would be, to human senses, instantaneous. Morpurgo was certain that the Core Death Wand device was somehow keyed to detonate as soon as they entered Hyperion space. The shock wave of death would reach the planet Hyperion in less than 2 seconds, would engulf even the most distant elements of the ouster swarm before 10 more minutes had passed.
Thus, said Mayna Gladstone, her voice betraying emotion for the first time, as Chief Executive Officer of the Senate of the Hegemony of Man, I have authorized elements of Force Space to destroy all Singularity containment spheres and Farcaster devices known to be in existence. This destruction, this cauterizing, will commence in 10 seconds. God save the Hegemony. God forgive us all.
Bridge Officer Salomon Morpurgo said coolly,
5 seconds to translation, Father.
Morpurgo looked across the bridge and locked eyes with his son. Projections behind the young man showed the portal growing, growing, surrounding.
I love you, said the general.
263 Singularity containment spheres, connecting more than 72 million Farcaster portals, were destroyed within 2.6 seconds of one another. Force fleet units, deployed by Morpurgo under executive order, and reacting to orders unsealed less than 3 minutes before, reacted promptly and professionally, destroying the fragile Farcaster spheres by missile, lance, and plasma explosive. 3 seconds later, with the clouds of debris still expanding, the hundreds of Force spacecraft found themselves stranded, separated from each other and any other system by weeks or months via Hawking Drive and years of time debt. Thousands of people were caught in Farcaster transit. Many died instantly, dismembered or torn in half. Many more suffered amputated limbs as the portals collapsed behind them or before them. Some simply disappeared. This was the fate of the H.S. Stephen Hawking, precisely as planned, as both entrance and exit portals were expertly destroyed in the nanosecond of the ship's translation. No part of the torch ship survived in real space. Later tests showed conclusively that the so-called Death Wand device was detonated in whatever passed for time and space in the strange core geographies between the portals. The effect was never known. The effect on the rest of the web and its citizens was immediately obvious. After 7 centuries of existence,
and at least 4 centuries where few citizens existed without it. The datasphere, including the all-thing and all-com and access bands, simply ceased to be. Hundreds of thousands of citizens went insane at that moment, shocked into catatonia by the disappearance of senses which had become more important to them than sight or hearing. More hundreds of thousands of datum plane operators, including many of the so-called cyber pukes and system cowboys, were lost, their analog personas caught in the crash of the datasphere, or their brains burned out by neural shunt overload, or an effect later known as zero-zero feedback. Millions of people died when their chosen habitats, accessible only by Farcaster, became isolated death traps. The bishop of the Church of the Final Atonement, the leader of the Shrike cult, had carefully arranged to sit out the final days in some comfort in a hollowed-out mountain, lavishly stocked, deep in the Raven Range of the north reaches of Nevermore. Redundant Farcasters were the only route in or out. The bishop perished with several thousand of his acolytes, exorcists, lectors, and ostiaries, clawing to get into the inner sanctum to share the last of the Holy One's air. Millionaire publisher Tyrena Wingreen Fife, 97 standard years old and on the scene for 300-plus years thanks to the miracle of Poulsen treatments and cryogenics, made the mistake of spending that fateful day in her Farcaster access-only office on the 435th floor of the Transline Spire in the Babel section of Tau Ceti Center's City 5. After 15 hours of refusing to believe that Farcaster's service would not be renewed shortly, Tyrena gave in to calm-call entreaties from her employees and dropped her containment field walls so that she could be picked up by EMV. Tyrena had not listened to instructions carefully enough. The explosive decompression blew her off the 435th floor like a cork out of an overshaken champagne bottle. Employees and rescue squad members in the waiting EMV swore that the old lady cursed a blue streak for the entire 4-minute fall. On most worlds, chaos had earned a new definition. The majority of the web's economy disappeared with the local dataspheres and the web megasphere. Trillions of hard-earned and ill-gotten marks ceased to be. Universal cards quit functioning. The machinery of daily life coughed, wheezed, and shut down. For weeks or months or years, depending upon the world, it would be impossible to pay for groceries, charge a ride on public transit, settle the simplest debt, or receive services without access to black market coins and bills. But the web-wide depression which had hit like a tsunami was a minor detail, reserved for later pondering. For most families, the effect was immediate and intensely personal. Father or mother had cast off to work as usual, say from Deneb Vier to Renaissance V, and instead of arriving home an hour late this evening, would be delayed 11 years. If he or she could find immediate transit on one of the few Hawking Drive spin ships still traveling the hard way between the worlds. Well-to-do family members, listening to Gladstone's speech in their fashionable multi-world residence, looked up to stare at each other, separated by only a few meters and open portals between the rooms, blinked and were separated by light years and actual years, their rooms now opening into nothing. Children a few minutes away at school or camp or play or the sitters would be grown before they were reunited with parents. The grand concourse, already slightly truncated by the winds of war, found itself blown to oblivion, its endless belt of beautiful shops and prestige restaurants sliced into tawdry sections never to be reunited. The river Tethys ceased to flow as the giant portals went opaque and died. Water spilled out, dried up, and left fish to rot under 200 suns. There were riots. Lucis tore itself apart like a wolf chewing at its own entrails. New Mecca went into spasms of martyrdom. Tsingtao Siswang Pana celebrated deliverance from the ouster hordes,
and then hanged several thousand former hegemony bureaucrats. Maui Covenant also rioted, but in celebration, the hundreds of thousands of descendants of the First Families riding the Motal Isles to displace the off-worlders who had taken over so much of the world. Later, the millions of shocked and displaced vacation home owners were put to work dismantling the thousands of oil derricks and tourist centers which had spotted the equatorial archipelago like pox. On Renaissance Vector, there was a brief spurt of violence followed by efficient social restructuring and a serious effort to feed an urban world without farms. On Nordholm, the cities emptied as people returned to the coasts and the cold sea and their ancestral fishing boats. On Parvati, there was confusion and civil war. On Sol Draconi Septim, there was jubilation and revolution, followed by a new strand of retrovirus plague. On Fuji, there was philosophical resignation, followed by an immediate construction of orbital shipyards to create a fleet of Hawking Drive spin ships. On Asquith, there was finger-pointing, followed by the victory of the Socialist Labor Workers' Party in the World Parliament. On Pachim, there was prayer. The new Pope, His Holiness Teilhard I, called a great council into session. Vatican 39 announced a new era in the life of the Church and empowered the council to prepare missionaries for long voyages. Many missionaries for many voyages. Pope Teilhard announced that these missionaries would not be proselytizers, but searchers. The Church, like so many species grown used to living on the edge of extinction, adapted and endured. On Tempe, there were riots and death and the rise of demagogues. On Mars, the Olympus Command stayed in touch with its far-flung forces for a while via Fatline. It was Olympus which confirmed that the ouster invasion waves everywhere but Hyperion system had simply limped to a halt. Intercepted core ships were empty and unprogrammed. The invasion was over. On Metaxas, there were riots and reprisals. On Qum Riyad, a self-appointed fundamentalist Shiite Ayatollah rode out of the desert, called 100,000 followers to him, and wiped out the Sunni Home Rule government within hours. The new revolutionary government returned power to the mullahs and set back the clock 2,000 years. The people rioted with joy. On Armagast, a frontier world, things went on pretty much as they always had, except for a dearth of tourists, new archaeologists, and other imported luxuries. Armagast was a labyrinthine world. The labyrinth there stayed empty. On Hebron there was panic in the off-world center of New Jerusalem, but the Zionist elders soon restored order to the city and world. Plans were made. Rare off-world necessities were rationed and shared. The desert was reclaimed. Farms were extended. Trees were planted. The people complained to each other, thanked God for deliverance, argued with God about the discomfort of that same deliverance, and went about their business. On God's grove, entire continents still burned, and a pall of smoke filled the air. Soon after the last of the swarm had passed, scores of tree ships rose through the clouds, climbing slowly on fusion thrusters while shielded by erg-generated containment fields. Once beyond the gravity well, most of these tree ships turned outward, in a myriad of directions along the galactic plane of the ecliptic, and began the long spin-up to quantum leap. Fatline squirts leaped from tree ship to distant waiting swarms. The receding had begun. On Tau Ceti Center, seat of power and wealth and business and government, the hungry survivors left the dangerous spires and useless cities and helpless orbiting habitats, and went in search of someone to blame, someone to punish. They did not have far to look. General von Zeit had been in Government House when the portals failed, and now he commanded the 200 Marines and 68 security people left to guard the complex. Former CEO Mayna Gladstone still commanded the 6 Praetorians Kolchev had left her when he and the other ranking senators had departed on the first and last force evacuation dropship to get through. Somewhere, the mob had acquired anti-space missiles and lances, and none of the other 3,000 Government House employees and refugees would be going anywhere until the siege was lifted or the shields failed. Gladstone stood at the forward observation post and watched the carnage. The mob had destroyed most of Deer Park and the formal gardens before the last lines of interdiction and containment fields had stopped them. There were at least 3 million frenzied people pressed against those barriers now, and the mob grew larger every minute. "Can you drop the fields back 50 meters and restore them before the mob covers the ground?" Gladstone asked the general. Smoke filled the sky from the cities burning to the west. Thousands of men and women had been smashed against the blur of containment field by the throngs behind them, until the lower 2 meters of the shimmering wall looked as if it had been painted with strawberry jam. Tens of thousands more pressed closer to that inner shield, despite the agony of nerve and bone the interdiction field was causing them.
"We can't do that, M-Executive," said Van Zeit. "But why?"
"I'm going out to talk to them." Gladstone sounded very tired. The Marine looked at her, sure that she was making some bad joke.
"M-Executive, in a month they will be willing to listen to you, or any of us, on radio or HTV. In a year, maybe two, after orders restored and rationing successful, they might be ready to forgive. But it will be a generation before they really understand what you did, that you saved them. Saved us all."
"I want to talk to them," said Mayna Gladstone. "I have something to give to them." Van Zeit shook his head and looked at the circle of force officers who had been staring out at the mob through slits in the bunker, and who now were staring at Gladstone with equal disbelief and horror.
"I'd have to check with CEO Kolchev," said General Van Zeit.
"No," Mayna Gladstone said tiredly. "He rules an empire which no longer exists. I still rule the world I destroyed." She nodded toward her Praetorians, and they produced death wands from their orange and black striped tunics. None of the force officers moved. General Van Zeit said,
"Mayna, the next evacuation ship will make it."
Gladstone nodded as if distracted. "The inner garden, I should think. The mob will be at a loss for several moments. The withdrawal of the outer fields will throw them off balance." She looked around as if she might be forgetting something, and then extended her hand to Van Zeit. "Goodbye, Mark. Thank you. Please take care of my people." Van Zeit shook her hand and watched as the woman adjusted her scarf, absently touched a bracelet comm log as if for luck, and went out of the bunker with 4 of her Praetorians. The small group crossed the trampled gardens and walked slowly toward the containment fields. The mob beyond seemed to react like a single, mindless organism, pressing through the violet interdiction field and screaming with the voice of some demented thing. Gladstone turned, raised one hand as if to wave, and gestured her Praetorians back. The 4 guards hurried across the matted grass.
"Do it,"
said the oldest of the remaining Praetorians. He pointed to the containment field control remote.
"Fuck you,"
General Van Zeit said clearly. No one would go near that remote while he lived. Van Zeit had forgotten that Gladstone still had access to codes and tactical tight-beam links. He saw her raise her comm log, but he reacted too slowly. Lights on the remote blinked red and then green. The outer fields winked out and then reformed 50 meters closer in. And for a second, Mayna Gladstone stood alone, with nothing between her and the mob of millions, except a few meters of grass, and countless corpses suddenly surrendered to gravity by the retreating shield walls. Gladstone raised both arms as if embracing the mob.
Silence and lack of motion extended for 3 eternal seconds. And then the mob roared with the voice of a single great beast, and thousands surged forward with sticks and rocks and knives and broken bottles. For a moment, it seemed to von Zeit that Gladstone stood like an impervious rock against that tidal wave of rabble. He could see her dark suit and bright scarf, see her standing upright, her arms still raised, but then more hundreds surged in, the crowd closed, and the CEO was lost. The Praetorians lowered their weapons and were put under immediate arrest by Marine sentries.
Opaque the containment fields, ordered von Zeit. Tell the dropships to land in the inner garden at 5-minute intervals. Hurry!
The general turned away.
Good Lord,
said Theo Lane, as the fragmented reports kept coming in over the fat line. There were so many millisecond squirts being sent that the computer could do little to separate them. The result was a mélange of madness.
Play back the destruction of the Singularity containment sphere, said the consul.
Yes, sir, said the ship, and interrupted its fat line messages for a replay of the sudden burst of white, followed by a brief blossoming of debris and sudden collapse as the Singularity swallowed itself and everything within a 6,000-click radius. Instruments showed the effect of gravity tides, easily adjusted for at this distance, but playing havoc with the Hegemony and Auster ships still locked in battle closer to Hyperion.
All right, said the consul, and the rush of Fatline reports resumed. There's no doubt? Asked Arendez.
None, said the consul.
Hyperion is an outback world again, only this time there is no web to be outback to.
It's so hard to believe, said Theo Lane.
The ex-governor-general sat drinking scotch, the only time the consul had ever seen his aide indulge in a drug. Theo poured another 4 fingers.
The web. Gone. 500 years of expansion wiped out.
Not wiped out, said the consul.
He set his own drink, still unfinished, on a table.
The worlds remain.
The cultures will grow apart, but we still have the Hawking Drive, the one technological advance we gave ourselves rather than leased from the Corps. Milio Arendez leaned forward, his palms together as if praying.
Can the Corps really be gone? Destroyed?
The consul listened a moment to the babble of voices, cries, entreaties, military reports, and pleas for help coming over the fat-line voice-only bands.
Perhaps not destroyed, he said, but cut off, sealed away.
Theo finished his drink and carefully set his glass down. His green eyes had a placid, glazed look.
You think there are other spider webs for them? Other Farcaster systems? Reserve cores?
The consul made a gesture with his hand.
We know they succeeded in creating their ultimate intelligence. Perhaps that UI allowed this winnowing of the core. Perhaps it's kept some of the old AIs online, in a reduced capacity, the way they had planned to keep a few billion humans in reserve.
Suddenly, the fat line babble ceased, as if cut off by a knife.
Ship? Queried the consul, suspecting a power failure somewhere in the receiver.
All fat line messages have ceased, most in mid-transmission, said the ship. The consul felt his heart pounding as he thought. The Death Wand device. But no, he realized at once. That couldn't affect all of the worlds at once. Even with hundreds of such devices detonating simultaneously, there would be lag time as 4 ships and other far-flung transmission sources got in their final messages.
But what then?
The messages appear to have been cut off by a disturbance in the transmission medium, said the ship, which is, to my current knowledge, impossible. The consul stood.
A disturbance in the transmission medium?
The fat-line medium, as far as humans understood it, was the hyperstring Planck-infinite topography of space-time itself, what AIs had cryptically referred to as the void which binds. There could be no disturbance in that medium. Suddenly the ship said, Fatline message coming in, transmission source everywhere, encryption base infinite, squirt rate real time.
The consul opened his mouth to tell the ship to quit spouting nonsense when the air above the hollow pit misted in something neither image nor data column, and a voice spoke.
There will be no further misuse of this channel. You are disturbing others who are using it to serious purpose. Access will be restored when you understand what it is for. Goodbye.
The three men sat in silence, unbroken except for the reassuring rush of ventilator fans and the myriad soft noises of a ship underway. Finally, the consul said,
"Ship, please send out a standard flatline time location squirt without encoding. Add, receiving stations respond."
There was a pause of seconds, an impossibly long response time for the AI-caliber computer that was the ship. "I'm sorry, that is not possible," it said at last.
"Why not?" demanded the consul.
"Fatline transmissions are no longer being allowed. The hyperstring medium is no longer receptive to modulation."
"There's nothing on the Fatline?" asked Theo,
staring at the empty space above the hollow pit, as if someone had turned off a holly just as it was getting to the exciting part. Again the ship paused.
"To all intents and purposes, M. Lane," it said, "there is no Fatline any longer."
"Jesus wept," muttered the consul.
He finished his drink in one long gulp and went to the bar for another.
"It's the old Chinese curse," he muttered.
Melio Arendez looked up.
"What's that?"
The consul took a long drink.
"Old Chinese curse," he said.
"May you live in interesting times."
As if compensating for the loss of Fatline, the ship played audio of in-system radio and intercepted tight beam babble while it projected a real-time view of the blue and white sphere of Hyperion, turning and growing as they decelerated toward it at 200 gravities.